vertebrae, ribs, and long bones. And the grislier truth was finally uncovered. The doctors then went to work removing it. According to the report, the contents of the tumor consisted of hair, mature bone, and other body parts. These body parts included multiple teeth, structures resembling limb buds. Its sheer size, 14 inches by 6 inches by 4 inches, would also make it the largest ever found in a case of adult fetus in situ. Thankfully, with the mask on, the woman had a speedy and uneventful recovery, and 2 years later is still doing very well. Quote, I am feeling very well, and my abdomen is now flat, and my parents are very happy, end quote, she wrote in a patient perspective included with the report. In an unsettling finale to this strange story, the doctors weren't able to scrape out every last cellular trace of the twin from the patient. So there's still a remote chance that some of those cells could behave like cancer and grow out of control. To mitigate that risk, the doctor said they'll be observing the girl on a yearly basis for signs of any trouble in the future. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no comments. Astronomers aren't done with major black hole discoveries this year. The Max Planck Institute of, some of these people's names, Kainush Mergan and colleagues have found the largest black hole ever observed at the center of a place called Home 15A. It's a galaxy about 700 million light years away. It's more than twice as large as the previously observed record setter at 40 billion times the mass of the Sun and 10,000 times the mass of the black hole at the core of our own Milky Way. The team spotted the black hole using data from the Very Large Telescope Array. The wealth of extra data from the Chile Observatory helped them map the structure of Home 15A in unprecedented detail, helping them run simulations to explain the galaxy's formation and its unusually faint center. Simply speaking, the black hole is so powerful that large. It's approximately 790 astronomical units, which is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Anyway, that it has either swallowed up the closest stars or tossed them towards the galaxy's edge. This isn't necessarily the largest black hole detected. That distinction does go to a quasar TON-618. An indirect study suggests that its black hole could be 66 billion times the Sun's mass. It's still gigantic, though, and it's about 4 to 9 times larger than astronomers expected. The discovery could significantly expand humanity's understanding of the scale of the universe, not to mention fundamentals like galaxy formation. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, maybe this one will be closer to people's hearts. If you have cat allergies, there might be some help for that down the road. News recently resurfaced of a potential vaccine that makes cats less able to cause allergies. But while this research is promising, a finished product won't be available at least until 2022. The vaccine in question is being developed by a Swiss-based company called HypoCat and is the company's lead experimental namesake drug. This April, HypoCat published results from a study on the vaccine, and it's this news that has caused the Internet to go abuzz with talk of cat allergy vaccines. The study, published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, details a very clever strategy to tackle cat allergies. The vaccine doesn't try to desensitize the immune system of people allergic to cats, as other existing immunotherapies like allergy shots do. Rather, it attempts to train the immune system of cats themselves to go after a specific protein or allergen and that they naturally produce, which is called CelD1. It's supposed to accomplish this trick by hitching a genetically modified version of a protein to a virus-like particle derived from a plant virus. It's only a particle, so it shouldn't be able to cause any disease. Some 90% of people with cat allergies produce antibodies to FLD1. So if successful, the vaccine would basically turn cats hypoallergenic by greatly reducing the amount of FLD1 they make and eventually spew into our noses and mouths. Let me drop for a sec. In the study, that's what the vaccine seemed to do. Across various experiments, more than 50 young cats were dosed with the vaccine, administered via a shot to their hind leg. In the latest experiments, cats were given 6 dosages over 9 weeks. Some cats also got a booster shot 6 months later. All the cats, they reported, developed a sustained immune response to the allergen, and the booster shot helped keep the antibody levels high. Antibodies taken from the cat's blood also seem to neutralize FLD1 in the lab, while the cats themselves produced less FLD1 in their saliva and tears. When these cat samples were mixed with blood taken from real human patients with cat allergies, they caused less of an allergic reaction. Most importantly, for animal lovers, the vaccine didn't appear to cause serious or long-term side effects in cats. One likely reason for this is that FLD1 doesn't have a crucial function in cats, as far as we know. Some cats are already naturally low in FLD1 without any apparent health problems, so the vaccine also doesn't completely eliminate the protein. HypoCat CEO Gary Jennings has stated that the company has been in discussions with both the U.S. and the European drug approval agencies, and that it's already started to conduct clinical trials and lay down the groundwork for mass production. But even if the vaccine passed these trials with flying colors, you'll still have to wait years before it could hit the market. A similar vaccine for dogs in development by a company called HypoDog is even further back in the pipeline. If all goes as planned, they hope to reach the market in 2022. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I thought I'd get some kind of a rise with cat allergy news, but I guess not. Give it one more pause, and then on to the next one.
Roy, with your permission, I'd like to go back one. The super large black hole, 40 billion solar masses. I think you said it was calculated to be something like 700 astronomical units, or 790 astronomical units. And you said that was similar to the Earth distance. Earth is 93 million miles. That's one astronomical unit. Pluto is 39 astronomical units. 700 astronomical units would be 20 times larger than our complete solar system when we used to include Pluto. So that's a pretty big black hole physical, if I got the math right. Odie Roy, KQIW.
Yeah, Dick, you got the math right. I'm sorry if you misinterpreted what I said. I was trying to say that an astronomical unit itself is the distance between the Earth and the Sun, and not that the number of astronomical units that the black hole was is that distance between the Earth and the Sun.
Now, when it comes to size of black holes, I may have mentioned this once before. We now believe there's something in the vicinity of 100 billion stars in our galaxy, and there's something like 100 billion galaxies. 100 billion is 10 to the 11. Total number of stars is around 10 to the 22, maybe 10 to the 23, 24. If you use that number of solar masses, assuming each star is in the vicinity of a solar mass, some are bigger, some are smaller, and you calculate the diameter of that object, assuming it's a black hole, it is close to 13 billion light years of radius. So in other words, the possibility exists that the amount of total stuff that we see in the observable universe is enough for the size, what we believe is the size of the universe, to have been a black hole. Isn't it interesting that maybe the Big Bang was really the whole universe as a black hole doing something? Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
I mean, there's all kinds of very interesting theories out there. By the way, the deep field telescopes have pretty much counted anywhere from 1 to 2 trillion proto-galaxies and galaxies in the universe that's observable. We don't know how much is not observable because of the light cone and the limitations of the speed of light in relation to where we are within the universe. So there's all kinds of interesting possibilities. One of the ones that I dislike the most is that we actually exist as a holographic presence on the surface of a very large black hole. I don't know about you. I don't really want to be a sort of two-dimensional surface on a black hole having some kind of holographic projection. But that's another idea that people are talking about who aren't drinking alcohol.
And there was another thing I was going to mention along these lines. All of a sudden, I've lost the train of thought. Oh, yes. The Hubble Ultra Deep Field, you did say, had some number of trillion galaxies in it. And we'd like to believe that because it was a 10 million second integration, that it caught everything. Unfortunately, Hubble only is in the near infrared. It doesn't go to far infrared. And when you look at the total amount of Doppler shift, what is it now called, the Hubble constant, the really far galaxies have so much Doppler shift that the observable light coming out of that galaxy gets shifted to the far infrared. The ALMA millimeter wave telescope in Chile is able to see galaxies that Hubble cannot see. So there's a lot more galaxies out there at the perimeter that even the ultra deep field doesn't see. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's all incredibly fascinating. A lot of those sites in the periphery close to the edge of the observable universe, though, go back again to something like 13.8 billion years. And so we're seeing very, very young galaxies, and we don't really know yet what that means. Does that mean that they all kind of age normally, or do they collapse in on each other, or what the heck happens after you let a few billion years pass? So it's there's a lot of things being discovered. There's a lot of new questions being brought up, and people are trying to figure out the answers to some of them. And, you know, like I said before, this is a real exciting time for science. We are living in the golden age of technology and science. It gives us information about things that we once upon a time did not even know existed. But you got to pay for it another way, and that was the other story about the self-driving cars. So the universe gives with one hand and takes away with the other. Okay, on with the next. We've all been here before. Some clever, reckless upstart comes up with plans that seem far-fetched to the entrenched experts. The upstart succeeds to one degree or another, but rather than just receive his laurel wreath humbly, he crawls farther and farther out onto that scientifically less supported branch until one day it snaps, and you end up reading about him dying in a hotel room, a hermit hiding from failed, exalted claims made almost a lifetime ago. Sometimes Elon Musk reminds me of the Yogi Bear line, it's like deja vu all over again. Musk's tunneling venture, the Boring Company, is trying for a bold transportation for the Consumer Electronics Show in 2021. But even that is showing its limitations as it competes against Vegas's own monorail. According to a TechCrunch report, the Boring Channel's Las Vegas project may significantly damage support columns for the existing monorail, and it will still require a human driver. In the past, the Boring Company had promised some type of efficient travel through narrow tunnels with electric autonomous vehicles with aligned wheels. Plus, back in May, the company released a video that showed they had done away with the whole alignment wheel thing entirely. So the company's transportation mode is now just a Tesla in a tunnel, because in Musk's words, this is simple and it just works. Somewhat related, and this is the important part, Elon Musk has also said all Teslas will be fully capable of self-driving and can serve as robo-taxis by next year. So if that's true, why human-driven cars for the Consumer Electronics Show tunnel in 2021? All these various promises seem to be a little more than idle boasts revealed in the TechCrunch report about the Boeing company's $48.7 million Las Vegas project. The project, if you recall, will use modified Teslas to move up to 16 people at a time through a tunnel the company digs under the convention center. Let me drop for a sec. The bulk of the report, which is worth reading in full, is about how the Las Vegas monorail is worried that tunneling may damage their support columns and force the monorail to shut down for costly repairs. Although the Boring Cut Channel's website states that the system would use autonomous vehicles, presumably using Tesla's autopilot technology, Levinowski, the Boring Company government relations executive, said that the Las Vegas Convention Center loop vehicles would actually also have human drivers for additional safety. So, we're all supposed to believe that Tesla will be capable of full self-driving in all conditions by next year, even though, by the following year, a safety driver will be needed for a 0.8-mile tunnel with a dedicated right-of-way, the single simplest application of self-driving that could possibly exist. Airport people movers, close relatives to whatever the Boring Company is building in Las Vegas, have been driverless for decades. Yet here, in 2019, the Boring Company says they will need a driver for their people mover, which moves fewer people over a shorter distance for additional safety. Like the Wizard of Oz once cautioned, don't look behind the curtain. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
What's unique about those tunnels, Roy? Are they going to be a vacuum tunnel, or do they run at normal air pressure?
This point, and it's subject to change tomorrow, I think it's at normal pressure. I think they did away with the kind of hyperloop concept for this particular thing. Basically, they dig a hole, they put a Tesla car or something like a Tesla car and a passenger vehicle, and they ride through it with a driver.
Okay. What advantage does that have as compared to a surface high-speed train?
Me personally, I don't have a clue. And I think that Elon doesn't have a clue either. At this point, he's just trying to prove a point, and it's a crumbling little point that he's trying to prove at this point. Maybe someone has a better feel for why this exists other than to have a neat name like the Boring Company.
Yeah, if he's really drilling a tunnel, somewhat like a subway, and you're going to put a car in it, to be efficient, the tunnel wouldn't be much bigger than the car, which means now you must move that whole column of air during the whole length of the tunnel in order to move the car. Or conversely, if the air is going to move around the car, then the tunnel has to be considerably larger than the car, not to build up a huge amount of back pressure. Either case, it doesn't sound economical. Over to you, Roy.
I would agree with you, and I certainly haven't invested in this harebrained scheme. But, you know, I told everyone about the scheme about putting the electrodes in people's brains, so I think this is going to end up being almost similar to that. If anyone likes the historical point, look up Spruce Goose, and I think that you'll learn a great deal about guys who do amazing things, start to believe their own public relations press, and then do really weird things.
In the past, when I used your website, roy.ac2gs.com, I would get a large number of URLs. When you go there today, you only get two URLs. So something has changed. Over to you, Roy.
You only get the first one is a Paul's. The second one is a video. When I finish today doing my stuff, because I don't know how many stories I get to, I will populate the rest of it with the rest of the stories.
That explains it. Thank you.
There is a method to my madness. Anyway, on to a very, very, very similar story. Don't feel that bad for good old Elon. He has partnered up with China, land of mad genetic scientists. As discussed earlier, the Boring Company's tunnel projects haven't had the warmest reception in the United States. But that might not matter as much in the near future. Elon Musk has revealed that he'll be launching the company in China while visiting Shanghai for the World Artificial Intelligence Conference between August 29th and August 31st. There are still many unknowns, including the first projects, but it's a big step for a company that has so far been content to focus on American efforts. Musk also hinted that the Boring Company was willing to create an underwater tunnel, though there haven't been any announced so far. The entrepreneur didn't explain just why the company was expanding to China, although there are a few potential reasons. For one, it might face less opposition from regulators and neighboring groups. Looser development rules might work in his favor. A larger, denser population might stand to benefit more from tunnel systems, perhaps. This also helps that Tesla is dramatically expanding its presence in China. The Boring Company would represent a convenient complement to the automaker's plans in the region. I am just wondering at this point, what will be Elon's take of the old spruce goose? I don't know. This guy just keeps on making the news. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2. Yes. Okay, look, on to actual science instead of mad science. In a classic physics experiment, scientists set up a quantum entanglement between sunlight and the light generated here on Earth. Researchers in China, the United States, Germany, and the United Kingdom wondered whether any two particles of light called photons could show the spooky interaction governed by the rules of quantum mechanics, even if they originated from vastly different sources. The experiment was mainly curiosity-driven, but it demonstrates that in the future, researchers might be able to use the sun as a source of light for quantum mechanic-related purposes. Quantum mechanics is a toolkit that scientists use to understand the smallest particles, like electrons and protons. It says that particle properties, like their energy, can only take on distinct values from a list. When you're not looking at the particle, they can take on superpositions of these values, meaning multiple values at the same time, but they collapse into just one of those values upon measurement. Multiple particles can entangle, meaning when you measure the particles, the values are more correlated than they would be by chance alone. They can also interfere, meaning that the quantum mechanics math makes certain combinations of values more likely than others. The experiment the researchers use is one devised over 30 years ago to show quantum effects between photons on Earth based on something called the Hung-Uhl-Mendel effect. In that experiment, photons enter a beam splitter from two sides. The beam splitter will either cause a photon to bounce off or pass through it. With two beams entering the beam splitter from either side, the possible results are both photons bouncing off and coming out on the same side they entered, both photons passing through and coming out on the opposite side from where they entered, or one photon bouncing off and the other passing through, in which case both photons will be on the same side. Let me drop for a second. But according to the rules of quantum mechanics, there is no way to distinguish between identical photons. So, if identical photons enter on both sides, then the mathematics describing this experiment cancels out the cases where the photons end up on opposite sides, and the experimenters will measure beams coming out of the same side of the splitter most of the time. The researchers performed the same experiment where one source of photons was sunlight collected with a telescope and fed into a fiber optic cable and through filters, and the other was a quantum dot, essentially an artificial atom designed to emit photons with identical properties. The test demonstrated that the sun and the quantum dot photons mostly came out on the same side of the beam splitter. The researchers further ran a test to confirm that these particle properties demonstrated the correlations indicative of entanglement, according to a paper slated to be published in Physical Review Letters. Ultimately, it's important for researchers to know that photons from disparate sources can entangle and interfere for various quantum technology applications. And the sun is a very different than a photon source in a lab. But mainly, This is a neat experiment that hammers home the fact that according to the laws of physics, two particles with exactly the same properties are indistinguishable, regardless of their origins, even if their sources are over 93 million miles apart. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I'll give you another one. If you get a cut on your skin, you stick a Band-Aid on it. But if you get a wound in your gut, what do you do? Well, doctors treat injuries to the intestines. They can't use patches or bandages because these materials don't stick to the slippery intestinal walls. Now a team from Harvard University has come up with a solution for this problem by using the body's own bacteria in a gel form. The hydrogel is made from nanofibers which can adhere to the walls of the gut created by engineering E. coli bacteria that naturally exist in our own digestive system. Now that sounds scary, but don't worry, the scientists use the non-pathogenic version of E. coli, which won't make you sick and actually helps to keep the gut healthy. The engineered bacteria can be grown in a lab and then added to syringes or sprays to be introduced to intestinal wounds and start their healing work. The hydrogel is of a similar thickness to the mucus produced naturally by the gut, and it even can be tweaked to target particular areas of the gut for repair. One of the scientists, Anna Diraj Thott, described the hydrogel as a hack of the body's natural wound healing process. Normally, cells which stick together as a biofilm can prevent a wound from healing, but here the same mechanism has been engineered to do the opposite and to actually help wound healing. The result is a kind of spray-on bandage for your gut, according to the scientists. Unlike most materials, the gel can survive passing through harsh conditions of the stomach with high acidity to reach the small intestine and can last there 1 to 5 days in the gut while it does its work. Currently, the process has only been tested on animals, so it could be a while before it's used in operating theaters. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Is this going to replace the platelet system? You know, you have platelets. You know, they're supposed to clog up things if you have any kind of a cut or an injury, right?
Now, platelets are the general instrument that the body uses to stop small openings, small wounds. They go into capillaries and such, and they clog up arterioles and venules. If you have a gash that's bigger than a certain degree, the platelets will help, but they need some assistance. That's why on the outside often people have to go for stitches, and on the inside sometimes they have to cauterize bleeds.
Okay, and now with the intestine thing, what are they using it? No, where somebody gets a cut, they're in a car wreck or something, and this is supposed to, what are you saying, that doesn't normally heal, and now they're going to use something else?
It's a new technology that they're trying to use to assist healing internal rips in the membrane. You could do surgery and remove areas. That's probably the easiest present technology. If they're small enough, you could rest the intestine and hope that it heals itself. This is someplace in between those two, where you apply a biogel material that acts as a kind of crazy glue for the inside of your intestine.
And where did they get this biogel from? It's coming from inside your body?
Combination of nanofibers, artificially synthetic fibers, and material bred from bacteria that's normal in all of our intestines. We have a large amount of anaerobic bacteria that sit in our large intestine, and for the most part, they help us. They help us in handling, digesting some nutrients and absorbing them, and in just the way that we deal with solid residue. If you give someone very strong antibiotics, I'm sure you've known people, they get a really bad case of diarrhea. One of the reasons why is because you're killing off the good bacteria that we've evolved to use over millions of years. So E. coli can be a disease. There are different types of E. coli. There are pathogenic E. coli that can make you very sick, but there are very safe forms of E. coli that are in every single human being's intestines, and they're doing a service for themselves and for us. So they take cell cultures of E. coli and extract out some of the biological compounds in it and embed it in nanofibers that they synthesize.
Oh, wow. Okay, very good. I got a rough idea what you're talking about, but very good. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Any other questions before I move on to the next one? Okay, it's not common that researchers discover what could be an entirely new part of the human body, but a team in Sweden claims to have uncovered an intricate network of cells underneath skin that helps process certain kinds of pain. And this finding could broaden our conceptions of how we feel pain, as well as how to relieve it. Typically, it's thought that we perceive harmful sensations on our skin entirely through the very sensitive endings of certain nerve cells. These nerve cells are not coated by protective layers of myelin, as other types are. Nerve cells are kept alive by and connected to other cells called glia outside of the central nervous system. One of the two major types of glia are called Schwann cells. The authors of the new study published this past Thursday in Science say they were studying these helper cells near the skin surface in a lab when they came across something strange. Some of the Schwann cells seem to form an extensive mesh-like network with their nerve cells, differently than they had interacted with nerve cells elsewhere in the body. When they ran further experiments with mice, they found evidence that these Schwann cells played a direct added role in pain perception, otherwise known as nociception. Let me drop for a second. One experiment, for instance, involved breeding mice with these cells in their pores that could be activated when the mice were exposed to light. Once the light came on, the mice seemed to behave like they were in pain, such as licking themselves or guarding their pores. Later experiments found that these cells, since dubbed nociceptive Schwann cells by the team, respond to mechanical pain, like being pricked or hit by something, but not to hot or cold. Quote, our study showed that the sensitivity to pain does not occur only in the skin's nerve fibers, but also in this recently discovered pain-sensitive organ, said the senior study author Patrick Ernsford, a pain researcher at Sweden's Karolinska Institute, in a release from the university. Ernsford and his team aren't the first to claim discovery of a new organ recently. Last year, researchers in the U.S. argued that a fluid-filled network called the interstitium, also found under the skin, coincidentally as well as the surrounding other internal organs, should be considered an organ, which we, of course, talked about here back at that time. But it often takes years before authoritative sources like medical textbooks decide to agree on the classification. Indeed, some of the other researchers quickly argue back that the interstitium isn't distinctive or confirmed enough to be enshrined as an organ. So, as with most things in science, there needs to be a lot more work done to study these cells and how they function. Mice are invaluable models for studying the origins of pain in people, for instance, but we know next to nothing about how these cells actually operate in the human body. All of the experiments detailed in the study only involve mice, so it's possible that this system doesn't exist or function the same way for human beings. Let me drop for a second. Given how difficult it's been to effectively treat chronic pain, any new potential lead is exciting and worth keeping an eye on. The mechanical olanzapine, that's feeling pain from a non-painful mechanical stimuli, such as when putting on a shirt or other types of skin touching, is often associated with neuropathy, said Ernfurs, noting that as many as 10% of people in the United States and Europe may suffer from this sort of pain. The mechanism that causes mechanical olanzapine are not known, because these cells are important for sensing mechanical pressure pain. They could also be involved in mechanical oedema, he said. The team next plans to study in depth how these cells are actually activated by pain, which would involve finding the proteins on their surface that respond to mechanical stimulation. They also plan to look into the role they might play in chronic pain using animal models. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
K2QR.
Yes, K2QR.
I just caught a portion of that, but does this have to do with peripheral neuropathy?
Unfortunately, no. This is only related to pain receptors. Peripheral neuropathy is usually a kind of a global loss of all the sensory nerve senses in an area. Usually, it's due to some damage in the actual fibers connecting from the area to parts in the spine or elsewhere.
Is there I'm talking about the pain component of peripheral neuropathy that people express.
Well, it's too early to tell. It's probably more likely to simply be the pain receptors that we already know about. The researchers are considering a certain odd senses of pain when pressure is applied, which isn't the usual presentation of a neuropathy that you're discussing. But it's a little too early. They don't even know if it qualifies as a different organ, how it interacts, and if it even occurs in human beings. They found this in animal studies.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Okay, very good. Anyone else with any comments or questions or answers? Okie dokie, now we're going to try something completely different, pretty much psychology. The study published in the journal Science a few weeks ago was a meticulous social experiment that took 3 years and over $500,000 to complete. A group of 13 research assistants were recruited for a trip around the world. They traveled to 355 major cities across 40 countries. In each city, they visited banks, theaters, hotels, police stations, and other public spaces, and turned in a lost wallet, which they claimed to have found on the street, to a nearby employee. The wallets were all see-through and contained a grocery list written in the country's primary language, a key, a business card, and a mail name and email address where the finder could presumably reach the owner. Some of the wallets also contained a modest cash sum, an amount roughly equal to about $13.45 in the country's currency. In three countries, specifically the United Kingdom, Poland, and the United States, some of the wallets had a larger cash bounty of $94.15 or had the $13.45 but no key. All told, the team lost a whooping 17,000 wallets. Averaging all the countries together, there was a clear, if counterintuitive, result. Fewer than half, 40% of people bothered to contact the wallet's faux owners when it had no money, but a slim majority, 51%, did when they spotted the cash. And for the wallets with $94.15 inside, an impressive 72% of people tried to return them. Let me drop for a sec. Why are people more likely to return the wallet when it contains more rather than less money, you ask? It's natural to think that it's simply because people are altruistic and because they care about the owner of the wallet. Study author Christian Lucas Zund, an economist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland, said at a press conference discussing the findings a few weeks ago, quote, "Our results suggest it's a combination of altruism and what we call theft aversion, which is an aversion to feeling like being a thief. As support for their theory, the team found that wallets without a key but containing money were reported less often than wallets with both money and a key. The key likely to be more personally meaningful to the owner might have motivated more people to act selflessly. The researchers also conducted another experiment and asked a group of volunteers to imagine how they would react to keeping a lost wallet. Overall, the volunteers said it would have felt more like stealing if the wallet carried money than if it didn't. And the more money the wallet contained, the more people would have felt like thieves for keeping it. The team also tried to rule out as many other possible explanations as they could. The list of factors that seemingly didn't influence people's willingness to return the wallet included the presence of security cameras or other bystanders where the wallet was returned, whether the country's laws punished people for holding on to lost property, the age of the recipient who took the lost wallet, and whether they were likely a local resident, the identity of the research assistant who turned the wallet in. Let me drop for a sec. There were, however, differences between the countries themselves. The majority of people living in Switzerland, Norway, and the Netherlands reported the lost wallets regardless of whether it had money or not. By contrast, the minority of people in China, Malaysia, and Peru returned the wallets in either condition, though the return rate did not increase when money was involved. Mexico and Peru were the only two countries where people were less likely to return wallets with money than without. The authors don't have any clear sense of why these countries might be different. The United States, meanwhile, was mediocre in its generosity, ranking 21st in honesty overall. Though again, for the wallets filled with almost $100, the return rate among Americans jumped substantially. As for why these differences exist, the authors speculate that our eagerness to return a lost wallet could very well reflect the local culture surrounding morality and civic responsibility to others. Countries with a strong social safety net, less financial inequality, and high participation in politics, such as the Nordic countries, might encourage a greater focus on the need to be there for anyone, stranger or not. Other countries might instead celebrate a culture of strong ties to family or close friends, which is often linked to a higher level of religiosity, or having a government with a greater corruption and less democratic involvement by citizens. And sure enough, in the study, it was countries with the former qualities that saw the highest rate of wallets returned. Still, the authors warned these are only correlations. But if our propensity to return a lost wallet really does indicate how altruistic and moral we are, then maybe we're not as awful a species as we think we are. At the very least, we might be underestimating our collective willingness to do the right thing. Let me drop for a sec. In two other experiments run by the team, they surveyed an online sample of Americans, 299 volunteers in total, as well as the United States economists, 279 in total, asking them to predict just how often people would return a wallet containing no money, $13.45, and $94.15. Both groups wrongly predicted that more people would keep the wallets if they came with cash, so the economists were slightly more accurate in their prediction. The team's experiments were mostly meant to study and establish a method to measure civic honesty, the author said, but the fact that regular people and even experts were off base with their cynical predictions could have broader implications if we aren't nearly as heartless as we assume ourselves to be, for instance, then there might be ways to boost our sense of social altruism even more. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
So I told my doctor I felt a little kleptomania coming on, so he told me to take something for it.
Very apropos. Any other questions, comments, statements, or what have you, before we roll this up for today? roll it up and call it a day. I hope people enjoyed some of the stories, and next week I will have more stories and maybe even an update of what happened to good old Mad Mike. Once again, I remind everyone, if you have any topics that you would like me to cover, any questions you would like me to answer, or if you want to refute something that I said, or if you have a mailbag question for Dick, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@MikeAllSign, which is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra .com. And you'll get links to all the things that I talked about tonight. If you go to my website, which you can get to by just opening your browser and typing Roy Romeo Oscar Yankee .ac2gs.com. So thanks for everyone who participated, and thanks for Dick and Paul. And let me give it over to Dick, and he will give it over to Paul for the space report.
Good stuff, Roy. Thank you. Paul, time to do your thing. They're playing your song, Paul, WF2NK2RIW. Tell us what's going on in space. What are those astronauts and cosmonauts doing?
Very good. Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And the astronauts are doing a lot. For one, they're going to do an EVA this coming Wednesday, a couple of days from now, 6:30 in the morning. They'll start televising that. And they're going to be going outside to hook up what they call ITER. ITER is the International Docking Adapter. I've talked about that before on the net, but Nick Hague and Andrew Morgan will be doing the EVA. And it should probably take 6-7 hours, I guess, to do it. They need a newer docking adapter because you're going to eventually have, at some point, two crew vehicles from the United States attached to the International Space Station. So there's one ITER or docking adapter attached already on the front-facing port of the Harmony module. And right now they have another location that they're going to use also on the Harmony module on the Zenith point, the part, you know, at the top of the that module. Each module has, you know, six openings, you know, six different sides to connect things to. So, for instance, the Harmony module on the one side connects to the main part of the International Space Station, you know, running all the way back. And then to the port side, you have the Japanese Kaibo module. And then to the opposite side, you have the Columbia module. That's where a lot of ham radio activities occur for the United States. But facing down, you have another berthing location for cargo vehicles. Well, cargo vehicles are not crewed vehicles. Crewed vehicles have smaller diameter connections to the space station, and you need that type of system because they dock autonomously in this case, and they'd be also able to separate from the International Space Station real quick. You put a crew in there and almost instantaneously separate from the space station if the space station was in danger. You couldn't do that with a berthing system or with cargo system that they have. The cargo vehicles have a different setup altogether. They have 16 bolts that have to be electronically driven to connect the seal. But with the other system, they have these rings that they connect. They have a soft capture, and then eventually the crew vehicle will pull itself into what they call a hard capture. And they are attaching to the pressure mating adapters, the same ones that were used by shuttle many years ago. pressure mating adapter. It's this conical looking thing, but it's offset, like an offset conical setup. It's around 22 degrees offset from the run of the module itself. And the front of that used to be good enough for the space shuttle to dock with. Now the years have gone by and they have a much better docking system, and that's why they need EIDA, International Docking Adapter. One was bought up many years ago and installed by another crew doing an EVA, and that's what they're going to be doing this time as well. Now, to do it, they have the robotic arm ready to be used to pull the EIDA mechanism. This is roughly a 3,000-pound thing. It's about 60, 70 inches in diameter, and maybe about 3 or 4 feet in depth. And the robotic arm will pull it out of its present location, located in the trunk of a Dragon cargo vehicle that was brought up a while back. That is presently berthed to the space station. So the robotic arm pulls it out and brings it very close to where it's going to be going, and eventually it will be a solid fit to the pressure mating adapter number 2 on the Zenith port of Harmony. And you're going to need the EVAs to do all the hookups they need, you know, to make sure everything's tight. And then they need to hook up power cables to this EIDA, data cables and all of that. They have to run different lines. A lot of lines have been run in previous EVAs, but now the final connections will be made. And then they'll test everything, make sure everything works, and they'll be good to go, waiting for one of two vehicles in the near future to be going up, either the Dragon crew vehicle or the Boeing Starliner. Both will have crews when they dock to the space station. So I thought that was pretty good. We'll be able to see that live or replays. NASA will have replays of the EVA as well in the future. Okay, let me just backtrack a little bit. Usually I do the next important launches toward the end, but this time there is one I don't want to forget. It's called CHEOPS. It's a space telescope. It's going to be launched in November from French Guiana. Not using the Ariane 5 rocket, which is a heavy lift vehicle. They're going to be using the Soyuz rocket. And, you know, it's the Soyuz rocket that has been purchased from Russia, so European Space Agency, you know, has taken over this rocket completely, and that's what they use for that medium lift vehicle. They have light vehicles, medium vehicles, and heavy. The lighter are the Vega ones, the medium is the Soyuz, and the heavy is the Ariane 5. So this telescope isn't as big as, for instance, some of the other telescopes that have been launched. This thing is around, the dimensions are actually 1.5 by 1.5 by 1.5 meters. It's not all that big. It only needs 64 watts of power. And the idea of it is going to be similar to a test mission. Now, this is flown by European Space Agency because it's built by the European Space Agency. TESS, which is in operation now, that SpaceX put up there a while back, which is doing a phenomenal job finding planets. This one is being put up by the European Space Agency and being built by them. And the idea is to actually look at the diameters, the array, they call the radiuses of the planets.
That's time complete.
So it's going to be so fine that it's going to be looking at planets that have already been discovered, and we'll be able to try to figure out the diameters. And by doing that with the mass and other information, they'll be able to figure out if this thing is a liquid planet, you know, that has water or not, oceans, or is it a solid rock that's going around its star. So I'm looking forward to seeing CHEOP go up. It's another acronym. It's characteristic in exoplanet satellites. So that's what they named it. So hopefully that gets up off the ground okay in November. It's got a diameter of like 13 inches, you know, for the year, for the scope itself. And it looks at wavelengths in between 330 and 1100 nanometers, so it's got a pretty good range. And that's pretty much it on the on that telescope. We'll cover it again in November, but I just want to bring it up now. Just to let you know that TESS is the only one doing Kepler type of work, you know, looking at the planets going in front of stars. There's a couple of them now that will be flying. Kepler is pretty much out. TESS is still doing good, but now it's going to be joined by CHEOPS. Let me drop it for any comments. Okay. Another piece of equipment that we followed going up to the International Space Station years ago, back in 2016, was the BEAM, the Bigelow Excursion Activity Module. And that's the one that was attached to the space station. That was actually attached to the Tranquility Module. And that was all brought up by SpaceX. And after it was attached, it inflated. And it's got these very thick walls. And it was supposed to go up there for 2 years. They have all kinds of equipment inside to check for air leaks, check for radiation, check for what kind of what happens when it gets hit with micrometeorites. And it's all been passing 100%. No damage to the thing. It's just a very good module. It's a lot smaller than the other regular modules. A bigger module might be 1,500 cubic feet. This thing's like 500 cubic feet. But it was a good test, and since it was so great, they were going to keep it for 2 years, and they were going to disconnect it and let it burn up. They are now going to keep it forever, like for the life of the space station, practically. They're using it for storage. They've got thousands of pounds of stuff in there for, you know, extra storage, just like in your house. You need a basement or something to, you know, an extra room to store all the stuff. They have that situation, too. They use another module pretty much for that, too, the Leonardo module. But this is extra. So there's a door on there. They keep it closed. And for the last couple of years, they've been going in and out, open the door, see how everything is. And it turns out it was a very successful system. Bigelow has a bigger module planned eventually to be put into space, maybe even a standalone space station. They're trying to contract with NASA to attach one of these big, they call it the D-330. 330 stands for 330 cubic meters, I believe it is. It's a very large setup. You'd be able to have, you know, 4 to 6 astronauts inside this thing. It would be multiple floors, levels, and so far they haven't gotten the contract, but they really would like to attach this thing to the space station. If not, Bigelow plans on eventually getting a ride to space and creating their own space station, maybe even put two of these B-330 inflatable spheres into orbit. And they tried to get the contract with NASA on the Gateway system. They wanted to attach it to the new proposed space station that's going to be going around the moon, but NASA's in a big rush to have people landing on the moon before 2024. But to do that, they need a contract that's ready, that has something. So they got Northrop Grumman, because they pretty much have a module that they could use right away called Cygnus. Cygnus right now is a
cargo vehicle like that's launched from American soil on the Antares rocket, also now being built by Northrop Grumman. And since this thing, you know, you can have, it's human rated, every time it docks to the space station, you have people going in and out. They are now, they are pretty much given the contract by the